Senate Rules. Welcome. We've got two things on the agenda today. First, our organizational meeting, adoption of committee rules, standard committee rules, and then we'll have a hearing on the campaign contribution issue that we're into. Thank you for showing up. First of all, for those of you that don't know, Craig Allen, Administrator, and Adam Mullins is our assistant, and this will be the show for the rest of the session. We have a couple of absent members at present, Senator Miller, Vice Chair, Senator Courtney. Thank you very much for agreeing to be the Vice Chair. We appreciate that. Senator DeBeyer, Senator Atkinson, thank you. The committee rules, standard rules. We have a motion to adopt.
Approval.
Or to adopt.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the
stand by here.
Model committee rules before us.
Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, let's chat a little bit about this campaign contribution thing. What we're trying to get done today, make sure we understand where we came from, so DOJ will talk to us a little bit, LC, understand the background, ramifications, and then I'm looking for suggestions from them on possible fixes and find out what's up with that. Secretary of State also will be here in Capitol Club. Just give us their words and any other public testimony if appropriate. But if we could get started, lawyers, to the front.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm joined at the table by Phil Schradl, who is special counsel to the Attorney General. And Phil is here in part because he has expertise in some areas that we'll be maybe discussing, but also because tomorrow afternoon he has a similar appearance in the House Rules Committee, and I have an obligation in court that will prevent me from being there. We appreciate the opportunity to be here and visit with you. I think to be most helpful to the committee, I'll just launch into a brief description of the core elements of the opinion that we designated opinion 8274. And I should say that you have that in the materials that we've distributed to the committee. It's the last several pages of the stack of materials that you have. In that opinion, we measured the a specific statute, ORS 260-174, statute involving generally with campaign contributions, against Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. And as a result of the examination, we concluded that that statute violates that provision of the Oregon Constitution. Now, when we wrote that opinion, we followed the methodology that we ordinarily do in analyzing constitutional questions, and that is that we looked first at the Oregon Constitution to determine whether the statute in question passes muster under that Constitution, and then we look only at the United States Constitution if the statute in question does pass muster under the Oregon Constitution. And in that instance, we found that because the statute failed the test under the Oregon Constitution, it wasn't necessary for us to examine federal law regarding the constitutionality of that statute. The main case that we relied upon in crafting that opinion was Vannata versus Kiesling, a 1997 Oregon Supreme Court case. And similarly, what we did in our analysis, in that case, the Supreme Court tested the constitutionality of specific campaign contribution and expenditure limits, both mandatory and voluntary, that had been imposed as a result of 1995's ballot measure 9. The court in that case found that there were problems with elements of ballot measure 9 because, quote, a contribution in and of itself is the contributor's expression of support for the candidate or cause. That really, in a nutshell, is a key piece of the Vannata opinion. And on the basis of that analysis, the court then began to examine what parts of ballot measure 9 could survive scrutiny under Article 1, Section 8, which is the Oregon provision which protects the free expression of ideas. And under that analysis, the court did sustain some elements of Ballot Measure 9. The court sustained voluntary limits, including, for example, the denial of tax credits for contributions to candidates who had declined to participate in the voluntary expenditure limitations that were provided in that measure. But as you know, of course, the court also held elements of that statute, of that ballot measure, unconstitutional, and particularly focused on the mandatory restrictions and the mandatory features of that ballot measure. You have the opinion in the materials that we provided you, all 35 pages of it. In the course of rendering the opinion, the court examined five different constitutional provisions in depth and methodically compared elements of the statute, about 15 subparts of the statute, to the various constitutional provisions. Now, it's important to note that in Van Atta, the court did not eliminate every hope of mandatory limits or regulation of contributions and expenditures. And in fact, we noted this in the opinion that we prepared and submitted to the Secretary of State. From the court's opinion in Van Atta, for example, the court said that a donation of something to a something of value to a friend who later and unexpectedly uses that thing of value to support the friend's political campaign is not expression. And since it wasn't expression, it wasn't something that was protected by Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. And as a consequence, the court suggested that that would be the kind of thing that it might be permissible for the legislature to prohibit or deal with. As another example of the kind of thing that the court suggested in Van Atta might be permissible for the legislature to act on, the court said imposition of disclosure requirements or even imposition of penalties or disqualification from the ballot, in the language of the court, quote, may not necessarily offend constitutional requirements. Now, the court didn't go on, unfortunately, to spell out in detail exactly the contours of what it meant by saying would not necessarily offend constitutional requirements. And in the court's opinion, the word necessarily is emphasized in the actual text of the opinion. So that was a very considered part of the court's opinion. So I offer that language because the Van Atta opinion does not foreclose all hope of mandatory limits or regulation of contributions and expenditures, but it did find that the statutes which it was examining in that case, the mandatory features of those statutes failed the Article 1, Section 8 test. Now, in a nutshell, that's the basis of the opinion that we issued and the core elements of the Van Atta opinion. I'd be available for questions or observations.
Not necessary.
Mr. Chairman.
You guys, yeah.
Pete, did you or have you given any thought to the constitutional authority of the Legislative Assembly to govern its affairs and that power coming from the Congress, from the Constitution, and then the relationship of Article 1, Section 8 and that legislative power? To what extent can we govern our affairs and not cross that threshold of violating free speech? And I think you kind of alluded to one possible point, and that was maybe voluntary kinds of restrictions with perhaps once somebody has volunteered to submit themselves to that authority, then sanctions might be permissible following that submission. Is that, am I following, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, one piece of Ballot Measure 9 that the court did sustain in Van Atta had the character of establishing a voluntary limitation, and the court appeared to approve of attaching some consequence to people who said initially that they would follow that limitation and who then did not.
So, Mr. Chairman, kind of a follow-up. If this legislature, the Senate in this case, chose to impose some, or at least make a provision within our rules to provide for a voluntary restriction on the raising of or acceptance of campaign contributions during the legislative assembly. And I don't know if you'd have to fill out an affidavit or by some signed affidavit or affirmation agree to do that voluntarily, then subsequently violated it, then it would follow that we could then, as a Senate, discipline that member for not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, let me say that I think one thing you asked initially about the interrelationship between your authority to regulate your affairs and Article 1, Section 8, and I would say at a minimum what Van Atta and our opinion and what I understand at least some initial feedback from your legislative council suggest is extreme caution in this area. And so what I would say to you in answer to your question, I would go back to the text of Van Atta, which appeared to sustain some forms of voluntary limitation. And I would say that before I was willing to say that a particular proposal that you might come up with for your rules that would try to fit into that kind of language from Van Atta, before I would be prepared to say, yeah, I think that that's going to make it or not, I'd really want to see the language of it, because it's an area where we know for a certainty, despite all the other uncertainties, we know for a certainty we have to proceed extremely carefully, and I would not want to mislead the committee by offering an offhand sense of, yeah, that would meet the requirements of Article 1, Section 8, mm-hmm. or would pass muster. But I would say that in Van Atta, the court appeared to approve of that general concept.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, kind of follow up. If we did do that, that wouldn't be the first time we've tested the limits of the Constitution, would it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, no, and it wouldn't be the first time I might have made a mistake about whether something was constitutional or not.
Thank you.
Let me put yourselves in our position. You know, we're quite happy before you guys start meddling with this thing. What do you have any suggestions, you know, for us as the Senate or as a legislature?
Mm-hmm.
Anything leap out at you that we ought to really be focusing in on? The volunteer aspect, mm-hmm. that seems to come through, I think, is to...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess I would have more of a process suggestion I'd have a substantive suggestion and a process suggestion. One, the substantive suggestion would be to look very carefully at the Van Atta opinion to try and discern, as I've suggested, there are perhaps some areas where you would not run afoul of the opinion. The voluntary area might be one of those avenues to explore and very carefully. And then the process suggestion is, I think that it would be important to look at the particular proposal before you begin to ask whether it's legislative counsel or the Attorney General's office, you know, is this going to fit within what the court seems to have suggested would be permissible in Van Atta or not.
Okay.
There are some, you do have some constitutional authority to set rules of procedure and so forth, and there hasn't been, I understand at least, a lot of jurisprudence about how those interact with Article 1, Section 8. So I can't give you a lot of guidance about that.
Yeah,
two questions. In terms of getting us in this mess, what is your understanding of how this opinion came to be?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the opinion, as indicated in the first line of it, was requested by a state official, the Secretary of State, and we responded to that opinion as we do to other requests.
Mr. Chair. Do you have any knowledge of who requested the Secretary of State to request opinion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I do not. And I have to say also that I've been deputy for a grand total of 7 days now. And so I was not involved in my former assignment with the intricacies of what transpired or didn't transpire, as the case may be. So I'm not able to help you a lot with how it came about, but institutionally how it came about was we were asked for an opinion by a state official and we rendered one.
One last follow-up. We were talking about our, in terms of our rules and our what we can agree to, who would have the ability to challenge the constitutionality of what we agreed to do? Who would have standing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, under Van Atta, the sentence that I suggested to you earlier as the core of the opinion, is that the contribution in and of itself is the contributor's expression and support for the candidate or cause. So presumably someone who wanted to be a contributor or wanted to do something that was purported to be prohibited by whatever rule it is that you might adopt, perhaps would be one person that would be a basis to try and make the same argument at any rate that the plaintiffs in Van Atta did.
Thank you.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to conclude that it could be someone outside this building who felt that their constitutional rights were being deprived under the current rules, and I'm not sure I know the history of who requested this, but I am certain, at least I believe I am, that it's not necessarily relevant. What matters is what the opinion is. But pursuant to that, I've heard some express that it's really premature for us to change our rules because, after all, this is just an attorney general's opinion. Could you give us some guidance as to how much respect we're supposed to give this particular opinion?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I hope
the Attorney General, the opinion.
I understand.
Okay.
I hope you would give it a lot of respect. I can tell you what the legal effect is of an Attorney General's opinion. It's persuasive authority when it's cited to a court. And we hope that judges are influenced by the quality of the work that we do in the formal opinion process. And, of course, we aim our advice at state agencies with the hope that they will follow it. But it is not an opinion of a court. It does not have the legal effect of striking down the statute in terms of the legal impact of the opinion, because, as you quite rightly point out, it's not a judicial opinion. But we do hope it's persuasive, and we do hope that it's followed by agencies.
What are you going to do if you don't persuade us?
Mr. Chair, I haven't launched on an effort to persuade you yet this afternoon.
Senator Miller.
Well, somewhat along that line of questioning, I wanted to know if, and it's been suggested by some that, well, we just don't do anything. We leave the statute in place. We still govern ourselves by the same rules. And who's going to gripe? Other than probably the citizen outside this process who may want to contribute, but I suppose they'd have to attempt to do that. I've noticed in the Capital Club rules, as I understand them, that it's certainly not good form for them to offer anybody anything during the session. Now, I don't expect that their rules will change in their voluntary organization. So would we be ill-advised just to let everything stay in place and wait for somebody to hold that first fundraiser or to write that first letter and see if they want to go out and challenge it, which might precipitate the recall or something.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I think really you're asking me about a political judgment more than a legal judgment. That is to say, there's nothing in our letter that compels this body to do anything in response to it. And it seems to me really that at the core of your question is an evaluation of competing policy choices and an assessment of how likely is it that various consequences may or may not occur. And our letter does not compel this body to do anything. So I'm not really sure how to approach to be helpful to you on your question.
You want to follow up?
Yes. Are you aware of agencies that have had an opinion rendered about maybe a rule they've promulgated that was, in your view, unconstitutional and just said, back with that? We'll go ahead and keep that rule in place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, my own personal experience doesn't include that, but doesn't include that experience. But again, I want to make sure you know that I have a 7-day window on the broad aspects of operations of the Department of Justice. I'd be happy to see what I can find out to follow up with you. As a point of kind of information, I guess, and we do, just as you would enjoy a cloak of confidentiality if you were to consult a lawyer in a personal matter, in order to facilitate the operation of departments and to make sure that they can express their policy in legal forms and elsewhere, we recognize and are under a duty of confidentiality as to specific communications between our office and agencies as to whom we provided advice. But I think I could probably find some institutional answer to your question, Senator Miller, that would help you know whether how widespread that experience has been as an institutional question, and I'll endeavor to do that.
Senator Minnis, and then...
Well, I'm just wondering, do you know whether or not the Secretary of State's office is compelled to obey your the Attorney General's opinion?
I don't know the answer to that question, Phil.
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, it's my understanding that state agencies are only compelled to follow our advice to the extent that if they fail to do so, we will not, or we do not have to, represent nor indemnify them if they don't follow our advice. So to that extent, as a practical matter, in many circumstances, it does have operative effect, but as a legal proposition, it's still not, a judgment of a court or anything like that that is enforceable. It's enforceable only through the operational effect that our office then would no longer represent them if somebody challenged them if they failed to follow our advice.
And notwithstanding the fact that the Secretary of State's office is another constitutional officer and not necessarily a state agency per se.
Chair Harper, Senator Minnis, I don't think that has any effect on that operational effect of what our advice has, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Shepard, for coming here today and speaking to us. You're in a very difficult position, and I would like to just clarify one thing, not to talk like a lawyer. As we speak here today on this issue, ORS 260.174 is still law. It has not been modified. It has not been repealed. It has not been struck down by any proper constitutional body. Is that correct, counsel?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordon, that's correct.
That's correct. So, in effect, if I were to take a contribution today, I would be in violation today of ORS 2.60.174. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, it would, yes, that's correct. The statute still exists,
correct.
And the fact that we've issued an opinion as to its constitutionality doesn't change that.
Right, and Mr. Chair, I want you to understand, I was not trying to set you up with that line of question, nor am I trying to show any disrespect to you or the Attorney General's office or the opinion. I was trying to underscore what you said about where you stand in the food chain, the judicial food chain, regarding a particular statute which is presently under serious constitutional question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pete, help me understand this as a non-lawyer. As I read the Venata opinion that you presented or outlined here, it very clearly talks to money as a form of expression and the giving of money, the contributing of money as a form of expression that's protected under both the Oregon and the federal Constitution. It doesn't speak to the receipt of money. And what I'd like you sort of to talk about a little bit about is it appears that the Constitution, the Oregon Constitution, grants the Assembly, each House, the right to set rules under what its members can do during the session. And I'm wondering, is there a legal distinction between not prohibiting someone's right to give money but restricting a member's right to accept money during the legislative session?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I understand the question, and it really goes back to something we had a brief discussion about earlier, and that is that there are two parts to that transaction the recipient, which is what your question is focused on, and somebody on the other end of that. The question was earlier, who could potentially raise a challenge to a rule that the body might adopt? And the reason that Banetta is still relevant in that context is that the focus of it was on the contribution in and of itself being an expression of the contributor's intent, of their idea, of their support for the candidate or cause. So even in the example that you described, it's very hard to separate out the constitutional analysis to focus only on the recipient, because there's someone on the other end of that transaction who under Banetta clearly has protected interest. I'm not sure whether that answers your question, but it's
you're saying it's the same thing.
It is. It comes down, the analysis becomes combined, because there's always, any hypothetical you can imagine, there's always a receiver and a giver. And the giver is potentially protected by the Banetta language.
There are minutes.
Well, I wanted to kind of pursue some of the things. Senator Courtney kind of alluded to the fact that this statute still exists. It's still on the books in the law. And that if you were to take campaign cash during the session, that you would be in violation of the law. And I think you said yes, you would, because the statute's there. But we all know that the Secretary of State's office stated publicly that they were not going to enforce that statute, which in essence renders that inoperative. Now, the question is, did the Secretary of State's office have to render that opinion? Did they have to say, we are not going to enforce this statute?
I think Phil has correctly described our authority with respect to agencies. That is,
they could have just gotten another lawyer, I suppose, couldn't they? Get outside counsel?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I don't think they could have gotten outside counsel. Chapter 180 generally, well, absolutely gives the Attorney General
exclusive
authority to
okay, so give legal advice. Your answer is not exactly correct. Technically correct, but given the fact the Secretary of State's office said, or at least in their analysis, you are their attorney and they're concerned about liability indemnification, they've chosen not to enforce it. In effect, there's no effect, so it's of no value. I mean, it's like it's ethereal thing that's out there with no effect at all. It's not a violation. There's nothing that happens. You know what I'm saying? It's like we're talking about the wind.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I agreed with Senator Courtney's question that the statute still exists, and I would stand by that answer.
Absolutely.
The statute does exist.
But are you in violation of the law? And when I say in violation of the law, to me that implies that there's some effect from a violation of the law.
Mr. Chair,
the law is of no value.
Senator Minnis, the conduct would still not measure up to the elements of the statute. Whether there's a consequence for that is a different question.
Okay.
And
but isn't
Senator
that what the law is all about? I mean, why would we create laws if there's no consequence for violating?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, you've identified the situation we're in because of the.
Okay. I don't want to just kind of talk around in circles, but I guess the point I want to get to is this earlier point about whether or not we have to do anything. Because it's clear to me, given the Banetta decision and the Attorney General's opinion, the issue is that we do need to do something. It has to be voluntary. And for those members that do choose to come under the authority voluntarily, sanctions are appropriate and potentially sustainable in a constitutional challenge. Is that a right, or do you have a different opinion? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I would again say that the judgment as to what you do in response to these circumstances is not compelled by our opinion. It's compelled, maybe you may feel compelled by other judgments.
Let me ask you a different question with the indulgence of the chair. If a member of this body accepted campaign contributions, and they were subsequently disciplined with a rule that provided and it was for that sanction, but it was not voluntary. It's something that the body is imposing on a member. And that member, who was the person receiving the sanction, subsequently filed suit saying that you're violating my constitutional right it's a free speech. Do you have an opinion as to whether or not that member would prevail ultimately?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think that would be exactly the kind of case that we'd want it, we'd need to look in the same kind of careful way that we did at 260 to 174, and engage in that careful comparison of the elements of the rule against the various applicable constitutional requirements. And I really would I would hate to give you an off-the-cuff opinion today, because the only thing that would be worse than saying I'm not going to answer your question today would be to answer it incorrectly and later have to come back and tell you how I was
wrong. My case if I was there. Sorry.
All right. Is it one more?
How do you know, Mr. Chair, is it relevant?
Yeah. Senator Miller, one more world-class quick question.
I didn't mean to contribute to us wandering down the path of suggesting that this opinion doesn't exist and that we need to, in my view, reflect in our rules the reality. And it's based on solid reasoning in this Bonetta versus Kiesling case. And just expressing, I don't think we'd be very well served to
ignore it.
And
it'd be quick.
I think what Mr. Shepard didn't say to Senator Minnis is that if someone decided to violate this current law, it is very unlikely that anyone would be prosecuted because it's unconstitutional. So we need to deal with that reality. And if I could ask Mr. Shepard, in light of that, if we develop rules that require disclosure of anyone attempting the solicitation, and then require disclosure of anyone who was successful at that and actually received something, that would be constitutional, would it not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, the Vannetta opinion contains language that approves the elements about Measure 9 that related to disclosure. And what I would say is that kind of rule has the potential to fit within that. And again, I would give you the same caution I gave Senator Minnis, which is we'd want to, before I could really give you a squared away answer to that, yes or no answer to that question, I'd want to know what the rule said exactly. But I think you're barking up the correct tree there.
Thank you very much. That was
thank you.
Appreciated. I know you didn't want to be here.
It's always a pleasure.
I'm sure. Thanks, Bill. Mr. Chamoff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council. I brought the brains of the operation, Senior Deputy Ted Reutlinger, with me. We can make the presentation quite brief, I think. We agree with everything that Mr. Schradl and Mr. Shepard says, and we'd be pleased to answer any questions you have.
Kind of the same question. Do you have any suggestions for the Senate, that you think are appropriate for us to pursue?
Mr. Chair, during the course of your discussion with the representatives from the Department of Justice, you've identified the two areas that we believe the Constitution leaves open for you to regulate, both a voluntary program followed by a sanction for violating one's pledge, and also a program that would require a person to announce the solicitation or receipt of a contribution, and then sanctions to follow that if the announcement were not made as required by rule.
Senator Gordon.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The two avenues that have been mentioned of dealing with this were, I think, voluntary restrictions on oneself and disclosure. Long term, those, of course, allow for contributions still to be made during the legislative session. If you were trying to not allow it, is it possible through the wording of a referendum that would go on the ballot that would amend the Oregon Constitution in a way that would allow the legislature to regulate itself to stop contributions? I realize that's long term. That's not something necessarily, I don't believe you could even do it on a May ballot, but is there language, now we're talking about amending the Constitution, because I realize we've got to get there, so that we could come up with a ban so we don't allow this during a session, whether it's this session or in the future?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, probably not. You could cure any problem under the Oregon Constitution by amending the Oregon Constitution to permit the legislature to have the authority to ban contributions, but in the opinion that we issued on this subject, we did continue on and analyze the validity of the statute under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution to believe that it would be invalid under that provision as well. Therefore, any amendment to the Oregon Constitution would be ineffective to grant you the authority that you'd be seeking.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chamoff, could you tell me, could you distinguish this particular statute with our, I think it's called the lobby gift ban, RS-244? How is this different than campaign contributing, limiting what members can take and be, have spent on them by the lobby? How is that any different than this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, there's no difference.
So, Mr.
You sure you want to do that?
Well, somebody apparently
it's getting worse.
Somebody apparently already has, because my understanding is so. I'm gonna. Somebody already has. I know.
I want to do one thing at a time.
Look at this thing.
Senator Menas.
I'm just adjusting my socks. Sorry.
I naturally thought that
I've embarrassed myself enough.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chamoff or Mr. Rettlinger, it seems to me in 1992, or 94, there a candidate named Denny Smith was running for governor during the time that I think there was a, well, I guess, during the time that we were in legislative session, which wouldn't have been 94, 93, he wanted to raise money. And it seems to me he got an opinion that said that this prohibition couldn't deny him from doing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, that's correct.
And yet this remains in the statute, is that...
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, then candidate Smith challenged only a portion of the statute, not its entirety.
So what I'm concerned with, not only our activities, but those who are beyond this building who may be engaged in campaigning as we speak, who may want to, would it be your opinion that they are not prohibited from raising money during the legislative session?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, that's correct.
And would it also be your opinion that we should remove this statute from the books?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, we have no opinion on that question.
Your opinion, however, is unconstitutional in its current form.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, yes.
Anything else? We'll see. Thank you, Gray. Thank you, Ted.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Patterson.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ed Patterson. I'm here in my capacity as president of the Capital Club this year, and at the request of Mr. Allen to present some points of view that we might have and share with you some of the rules that we have. In the way of a background, Mr. Chair, the Capital Club began in this august building in 1959, and like I'm told, at least I wasn't around, contrary to popular belief, I'm told it was a more of a social motivation than anything else, and we started the Hello Party and that kind of thing. But it has been around for about 42 years, and like most institutions, it tends to evolve in different ways. And while rummaging through some of my stuff, I found a 1973 Capital Club book, which I thought was very interesting. And some of the people that have contacted me about what's going on right now, used to be members of the lobby back in those days, and so their input in our position, I think, is very good. I thought it was interesting that there were some introductory comments written by then Senate President Jason Bow and Richard Eyman, the Speaker of the House in those days, in the Capitol Club book. And there are some, a lot of changes have been made even since 1973 in the way, in terms of the way we operate as an organization. There were no bylaws in those days, apparently. The statutes were copied in here that controlled the lobby. And there were some administrative rules that basically decided, house rules, that basically decided who would be a member of the lobby and who wouldn't be a member of the lobby. And in fact, you had to lobby with, or you had to register with legislative counsel if you wanted to lobby in the legislature back in those days. So I thought it was fairly unique. And any five members of the legislature who didn't like the way you lobbied could petition the House Judiciary Committee and they could remove you from lobbying. So we've changed considerably since then. That kind of hammer doesn't exist in the current organization of the Capitol Club. We now have a set of bylaws, and I think Mr. Allen has copied at least portions of those for your edification. The membership to the Capitol Club is voluntary. We are a non-profit, private organization. We are a professional organization, and the basic purpose for our being an organization is to try to maintain that professionalism. And membership is a privilege as far as we are concerned. And we try to reflect that in the bylaws. And you'll note on page one of the bylaws, it says in the preamble that persons not agreeing to or not adhering to acceptable standards of conduct and professional responsibilities as set forth in these bylaws shall be denied membership in that organization. And then it goes on to lay out the articles of conduct. And number 12 in those articles states clearly no member during, and this is taken directly out of the statute that's already been cited to you by some of the attorneys, no member during a session of the Legislative Assembly shall make or promise to make a campaign contribution to a legislative official or candidate or to the officials or candidate's campaign committee, or promise to make a campaign expenditure in support of the official or candidate, including contributions and expenditures of political committees of which the member is an officer or a member. And that is the ruling code of conduct as far as our organization is concerned as it relates to this issue. Now, I have been asked periodically a number of times in the past about just what happens if someone does violate that. And our on page 4, we have Article 4, Rules of Professional Responsibility, states the duties of the rules of the Professional Responsibility Committee, and that is the Judiciary Committee, if you will, in making a judgment of whether one of our members has indeed violated the Code of Conduct. And this stipulates that a member of the legislature or a member of the Capitol Club itself can file charges against any member who may be in violation of the Code of Conduct. And of course, then it goes on to lay out in some detail about what happens if that's the case. And I have been asked if this has any force and effect with the members, because certainly does not have the force and effect of law. But it does lay out a method of prosecution, if you will, of that member who has allegedly violated this principle. And so the ultimate sanction that the Capitol Club has on its members is we can remove the member and then inform the rest of the membership, the other members of the Capitol Club, that member has been removed for cause. And we think that it has a significant effect on the professionalism of that individual. So that's the bottom line as far as we're concerned. Just comments, we have not taken an official position on what the discussion is right here as a organization or as a board of the organization. We will be meeting tomorrow for the specific purpose to reinforce what our position is. But I need to tell you that a number of the members have contacted me either by phone or as we cross in the halls. And the members I have talked to, and I should point out that most of them have been around a while, are very supportive of us taking a very strong position and making our members aware that we do not intend to tolerate any violation of this, regardless of whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional. We think it's a private club, and those are the rules for membership in the private club. And we think it will have, we hope it will have a significant effect on those individuals. Just taking off my hat for a minute, as president of the Capital Club and put on my personal hat and a little anecdotal story. My first session here was in 1971. I was elected to serve in the House, and like many people serving the first term, I think I was, looking back, I was very naive as to how this process worked. And I guess I was told by some of the old-timers, that old-timers mean fellow members, that there was a certain chairman in the Senate that if you'd go over there and wanted to get your bill out of the committee or wanted to get an amendment to a bill or whatever, it was almost, if you were a lobbyist, it was a sure thing. He'd reach down in his bottom drawer on the right-hand side, he'd open it up and he'd pull out 10 tickets to a fundraiser. And he said, "What a coincidence, I just have 10 tickets left and only $100 apiece to go to my fundraiser next week, so you're in luck." Now, that shocked me as a new member of the legislature back in those days, but I believe it was a true story about the conduct of this individual. And I would not like to see the Oregon legislature go back to that type of a system and have an opportunity for that to creep back into the system. So from a personal standpoint, I think this AG opinion leads us down that slippery path that we don't want to go down. And I will use whatever influence I have on my governing board to make sure that we stand tough on our rules and support the prosecution of any of our members who would violate those rules.
Thank you, Ed, but you know, as long as you're here. So you've got to, don't write about that. You've got internal code of conduct for a private club.
Yes.
Whether some of those codes are constitutional or not, you don't care.
Not at this juncture, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. And you're going to look into this in a little more detail tomorrow, perhaps.
We will.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, sir.
Chairman, or Senator Menes.
Ed, the story that you just told was who again?
Senator Menes, I didn't mention any names.
Do you happen to know the name?
Yes, I do.
And do you have any firsthand knowledge of that happening? That experience, was that something that was related to you from some?
Senator Menes, that was something that was related to me by more than one of my fellow members of the House at the time, and that was just standard operating procedure and didn't violate any law or any rule at the time.
Right. I'm just wondering, because I've heard that same story, but it was always put in the context of a California legislator. So in my 15 years in this process, it's the first time I've actually heard it applied to an Oregon legislator. I mean, it's not necessarily but... Oh, you have? Oh, I'll talk to you later then. Okay.
Well, in that regard, Senator Menes, I talked to some of my fellow hospital association lobbyists around the country, and I think we all have done that with other states and their legislative bodies. And the horror stories are rampant about the conduct and the lack of morality in terms of how these things take place. And
well, that's, you know, we're sorry we're having this discussion. You know, we shouldn't be having it, but we are. And I think I heard what you're recommending, that we keep this concept in place in some manner, fashion, strongly keep this.
Yeah, absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, we're just trying to fashion the who and what.
And I have a question for you, and I guess part of my, I feel like we're missing pieces of this, and the current statute prohibits other elected officials from raising money or from other people from raising money during the legislative session, and the proposal we have in front of us prohibits legislators from raising money for legislative campaigns during the session. It wouldn't prohibit or make me announce when I raise money, if I, for example, were running for county commission chair in Wallowa County, and it wouldn't require Randall Edwards to come to our Senate floor when he decides he wants to run for governor or whatever. I'm just using examples. Could you talk to me about the policy reasons why other elected officials were prohibited from raising money during the legislative sessions, if you know? I mean, why do we care if, you know, Governor Kitzhaber's out there raising money during the session?
Well, Senator Brown, I haven't seen in writing the proposal before you, so I can only comment that it seems patently unfair to me that if someone outside the building that Senator Miller has mentioned may be out raising money as we speak, and I presume legally because he's not a member of the legislature, and maybe the candidate is running for governor of the state, and yet there is someone who is a member of the legislature who also is looking forward to a gubernatorial race, but is prohibited because of his or her membership in the legislature from raising funds, campaign funds. So from a fairness standpoint, if from no other standpoint, it appears to me that that is not, the fairness of that is not what is something we need to consider when you folks are rewriting the law if that does take place.
Further questions? Ethical Senator Miller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe just if Mr. Patterson knows or if the administrator can discover this. I suppose, Senator Courtney, you're not midterm. He's in midterm. Suppose we had a midterm legislator. Well, suppose we had any legislator here and they thought about running for a federal office. Did they come to you during this session and ask you for a campaign for a contribution to their election to Congress or the United States Senate? Any prohibition on that? As long as it's something other than legislative office?
Well, Senator Miller, I can't speak from any personal experience in that regard. There may be some others in our organization that have been solicited for that reason, but I think the response would be from anyone who's been around a while and reasonably knowledgeable about our own bylaws, they would be prohibited from making a contribution of any kind to that legislator as long as you were in session. I think that's the way it's been interpreted.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking us to be here, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it.
Hard to live without it.
One of the questions that have come up in this contribution thing is reporting requirements. We'll probably have a hole if we continue down this path. So we've asked the Secretary of State's office to talk a little bit about it. Give us, where do we need to go, where do we need to go?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us. I'm Lynn Rossick, State Elections Director in the Secretary of State's office, and with me today is Fred Neal, who is the Campaign Finance Manager. And we were asked to join you today to talk a little bit about the disclosure requirements for campaign contributions and then to answer any questions that you may have based on that or your other discussions. As I'm sure all of the members of the committee are aware of because of your experience as candidates, state law in Chapter 260 requires a series of contribution and expenditure reports that are related to individual campaigns. So a candidate, a state candidate, will file reports, two reports before each election that they participate in, the primary and the general election, and then one report following each election. So that the last full report that candidates for the November 2000 election would have filed would have been the post-election report in early December. In following that report, there was one other report that had to be filed by candidates at the in early January. Actually, it was just due last week, that showed contributions over $500 during the month of December. Following that report, there are no other reports that have to be filed with the Elections Division until September of 2001, when every candidate that has an open committee will have to file a what we call the September supplemental. And that report will report all activity between the post-election report and the end of the accounting period in September. And then candidates continue to file those reports until their next election. So if a senator was just elected in this November, they would file September supplementals for 3 years until the next primary election. And so that is the series of reports that we have right now.
Okay, so we're talking about this theoretical hole between November and next September.
Right. Well, that's always been the filing duration. There never were any reports that were during the legislative session.
Well, there wasn't late.
What's different now? Well, during the legislative session, the law that we're talking about, 260-174, has prohibited making contributions. Mm-hmm. Persons could still make expenditures, And those would be reported in the September supplemental. So that period is covered there. And then of course, once the session is over, candidates can take contributions again.
Mr. Chair, Fred Neal, the prohibition against contributions from January 1 through sine die obviated or made unnecessary any additional supplement to the post. So that's why the supplement to the post ends on December 31st.
Okay, here's the assumption. Contributions are legal. What kind of reporting requirements do you think we need to get into? What would be your suggestions?
Well, Mr. Chair, under current law, those contributions would all be reported in the September supplemental. What we're talking about, I guess, if we're going to allow contributions during the session and you want to know about them before September, that we'd have to have additional reporting requirements of some sort added to Chapter 260 to do that. Because right now the Secretary of State does not take any reports from candidates during this period of time.
And that's 260, is that it?
Right.
Thanks. My understanding is that Secretary Bradbury is in the process of implementing an emergency rule that would put in 48-hour reporting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we received an inquiry this week from another senator, Senator Metzger, about the possibility of implementing such a rule, and we referred that to the Attorney General's office because we did not understand that we had that authority to do that, and we are in the process of receiving advice from them on that subject. If we receive advice that we have the authority, obviously we would consider that, but my understanding is that the early indication is that we do not have that statutory authority. We are going to have the statutes amended if that is to happen during the legislative session.
Okay. Mr. Chair, then a couple of follow-ups. Is a 48-hour reporting period during the legislative session something that's feasible for you to implement?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, it's feasible if it's limited. If it's to list such as the supplement to the post does now, contributions of a certain size, or it's even feasible certainly to list all contributions, putting anything $50 or less under miscellaneous contributions, $50 or less. That would be feasible. If it's a detailed report that makes each political committee and candidate committee itemize every contribution and expenditure and other receipt and other disbursement, then you're making it more complicated. And that really comes down to the point of how much information would you feel needed to be disclosed by whom, how often, if it is to pretty much immediately disclose contributions, then we have discussed that, and we certainly feel that with a minimal amount of additional resources or in computer programming or staff that we could do that.
Ms. Tammany, FDE. but the supplemental one line, one page, something like that would be,
right.
I mean, in that 24 hours would not be out of the question.
Right.
For us.
Mr. Chair, we could do that. We've talked to, internally in our staff, and what our plan would be, in addition to having that available to the public, is we would post that on our website. So it would be available.
Yeah. I was just going to say, there's nothing that prohibits us by rule from developing our own form consistent with what we know the existing requirements are within the Secretary of State's office. We all have web pages. We have the Oregon Legislative Information System. There's nothing that prevents us from posting it on the existing websites and then complying with the state statutes for supplemental September reports anyway. Because even if we wanted to change the law now, you've got a little bit of a lag in time. So.
Senator Miller and then Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I appreciate the question. I think in what Senator Minnis has said, we could cause ourselves by rule to publicly announce any fundraising activities we've engaged in and how successful we've been and at the time any checks or funds were received. That would not be difficult to do. Just go to the floor and announce it. What I see as difficult is, again, for those people outside of this building, if they once solicited for a fundraiser, you would have to report within 48 hours or whatever this period is, every time you sent out a letter. And suppose you got a half dozen letters done one day, I suppose within 48 hours somebody'd have to tell you that they attempted this solicitation. On the return, sometimes, in my experience, that not all funds are received at the same time for a single event. And so each day that something might have come in, you'd have 48 hours from that time frame to report something to you. And I think that's probably more of a bookkeeping headache than you all need. I think that the principal benefit for us is to report it within a short time frame, 24 or 48 hours, and the public will know who's attempted, who's been successful. My guess is there aren't going to be any of these reports, but we can handle, I think, most of it by rule.
So, actually, Mr. Chair, my question is for Senator Miller. Two questions, then. How do you address the issue of other elected officials fundraising during the session? And why would you leave legislators at an unfair competitive advantage to their opponents, since they could continue to fundraise during the session, no reporting requirements, and legislators would be exposed anytime they took a dime? Why would you put ourselves at an unfair advantage to other candidates that are currently out there raising money in terms of disclosure requirements?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I think you have to pay attention to what we're told is constitutional, and it is the view of counsel that this activity is constitutionally protected, so people outside, inside this building, can engage in that activity, whether they're running for a legislative office, a statewide office, whatever. I would certainly advocate, as I have done in, frankly, prior sessions, for additional reporting periods. I don't think it would be all that difficult for the Secretary of State's office to accept at least quarterly reports on fundraising activities, which would capture both if anybody was doing this here in this building, as well as people outside of this building would have to report at some threshold what their fundraising activities have been.
Mr. Chair, but you would agree with me that your rule doesn't cover legislators' fundraising for other purposes?
I asked the question about what the restriction was in the law, and I guess the answer was no, it's not covered.
Okay.
But again, if the benefit in the reporting is that if the public, which some people believe is so offended by this activity, learns of it, they can take an appropriate action. They have a remedy. And if they really think it's offensive, they can start a recall, I suspect. If they find it offensive and can't be explained by someone who engages in that activity, well, there's another election coming. And if the public, the constituents of one person, does not appreciate that activity, they'll probably make a choice. I think we arm them with information, which is, in my view, the best defense against impropriety.
I totally agree. That's why I think we need both approaches. We need a Senate rule requiring us to report, assuming we fundraise for our own campaign, but we also need stepped up reporting to the Secretary of State's office for everyone so that we know who's taking dollars during the legislative session. So I agree with you,
yeah.
But I think we need both.
Do we know yet whether you can do additional CNEs by rule or you need a statute change? You see, you're still researching.
Mr. Chair, we asked the Attorney General for some help on the issue that was raised in Senator Metzger's letter that he sent us, I think, yesterday or the day before, and I think we'll hear back from him probably tomorrow.
Okay.
And so we'll be able to share that with you then.
Okay.
My indication is that their preliminary review is that we do not have the statutory authority to do that by rule, that we would have to actually have the statute amended.
Okay. Take a look at 261. Also here.
Okay.
Anything else, Secretary of State? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Having fun yet? Did we have any public testimony? Okay. Well, with that, the public hearing is closed.
Oh, I thought it was interesting.
Did you ever see it? Yeah, may I continue?
Yes.
That will open a work session, yeah.
Are we done?
No, what did you hear, and what do you think we ought to do, Senator Beyer, today? What's your opinion?
It appears that at least we ought to adopt a rule that deals with disclosure, and I think the one in front of us does a pretty good job
of that. That's Senator Miller's concept.
So, I'm disappointed that we're constrained and can't do more, but apparently at the least we can do this. I'm not sure. I agree with Senator Brown that it'd be nice if you dealt with the offices outside, but I'm not sure that you can deal with that, even if, which a lot of our term-limited members have done, have decided that they're going to be county commissioners when they get done. Even if you're doing that, the reporting would be to, under the current structure, would be to a county clerk someplace. Or if it was a federal office, it'd be to the FEA. So you're still not going to get that kind of reporting. I'm not sure of a way to get to that. But I think we ought to do at least this.
At least something like that. Yeah. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly agree with the disclosure requirement in our rules, and I'm anxious to work with Senator Brown on disclosure for candidates running for a variety of offices by increasing the number of reports, and that probably will require a bill and a change in the statutes for the Secretary of State's conduct. I would support that.
So you see the CNE as being an issue also?
I do. Yeah.
Senator Vice Chair Courtney.
Well, I'm of the opinion that even though we have an advisory opinion that tells us that the 2.6.4 is unconstitutional, that for purposes of this session, we should continue to comply with the spirit and intent of the law, and that therefore that I think the disclosure issue still allows activity that we have been advised by the Capitol itself, the Capitol Club themselves, that they would hope that we do not start to put them in a situation where they feel undue influence, let alone those of us on this side, and that we need a longer look at how we're going to deal with this issue than we have, because we've just started the session. It's just been dropped upon us. I think that we can say that we, for purposes of this legislative session, are still bound by this law, and we will hold ourselves accountable. The fact that the Secretary of State will not enforce it is of no moment to me, because we internally have rules and regulations right now regarding protocol and some other activities that we claim that we will censure someone for. And I'm not so sure that on occasion that maybe some of those things we'd censure someone for, Mr. Chair, might be found unconstitutional if they were brought to a court of law. We are a group of people that, as you say, there's an internal code that is an operation of the Capitol Club. I think that we should view 2.6.4 as an internal code at this time for purposes of at least this legislative session, and we should not rush to some kind of disclosure approach, which would in effect allow us to solicit and to collect funds, as well as to allow the lobby to participate in that same process. We have worked very hard this session, I believe, Mr. Chair, to bring credibility back to this legislature in terms of the partisanship issue. We're working very, very hard on that. I compliment those in control and the majority for all their efforts. I think we're on the hot seat in this thing, and we should work very, very hard to make sure that the public can see this session is a session where, despite this opinion, despite the Secretary of State's representation, we are going to consider the ban to be in effect. We are going to consider 2.6.4 to still be a law in effect, and that is how we should proceed for this first session of the century, the 71st session of the Oregon Legislature.
So, status quo, old rule.
Correct.
Senator Atkinson.
At this point, I would agree with Senator Courtney that the current law provides us not only cover, but it also holds us to a higher standard. And I think that whatever we do should hold us to a higher standard because we are looked upon as a legislative body, as representative of the people, et cetera. There's a couple of pieces that I think need to be fleshed out. I think over time I could come to enjoy something that would have an additional reporting period. I think over time I could get comfortable with holding that standard while not having any discrepancy between a member of our body that wanted to run for Congress or wanted to go for governor or return back to county commission. The problem I have with the status quo, the thing that I think that we don't have fleshed out, is if we hold ourselves to the current standard and somebody does want to run for another office, county or state, the burden of proof then becomes on that one individual, even though they did something legal. I think there's a negative burden of proof upon that person, even who abided in the law. That's what I believe has to be fixed.
The additional reporting.
Well, it's not necessarily the additional reporting, but under current law, the law that at this point I'm comfortable with staying at, if Senator Brown wanted to move to allow a county to run for county commission, it would then become, and she did that legally, she raised money for that race legally under the law. It still does not allow her the cover of public perception that she did something wrong. I don't know if I'm describing that very succinctly, but I don't think that the current law provides enough, levels the playing field enough. I'm probably not being as particular as I can be, but that's my problem. I think there's a whole bunch more to this.
We need a little bit more.
But at this point, I agree with Senator Courtney until we have fleshed out the discrepancy that I see.
Senator Minnis.
Sure. I think you can go either way you want. You can go reporting, you can go announcements, you can go compliance with 260, but I think that the essential element of what we've heard today is that whatever happens has got to be voluntary. Yeah, if you're going to meet a minimum threshold of constitutionality, it has to be a voluntary affirmation on the part of the member. Now, I think peer pressure here is an important part of what we do. If we have a voluntary rule that conforms with, in essence, what 260 says, and we're required to sign an affidavit, that's saying that we will come under the authority of the Senate rule voluntarily, we then subject ourselves to the future discipline, and I think the sustainability of that discipline by the Senate. Those members who choose not to comply with 260, the essence of 260, suffer the consequence of whatever public scrutiny might come from noncompliance. That's my opinion.
Reporting aspects?
You know, 6-1, half a dozen of another. I think if you go the route of dealing with Secretary of State's office, you've got a lag time in terms of getting a law change. So I think as a practical matter, you could do reporting in 24 hours. It isn't that difficult. If the Secretary of State's office was willing to, even without authority, say we will voluntarily post whatever filings the Senate places in our possession on a web page that we have in existence, that's fine. I mean, it's just a matter of filling out a form and faxing a form to them or electronically transferring it via email. And most of us are pretty competent, or at least we have staff that are. So, you know, I'm flexible. I just think the key element is we have to literally come under voluntarily the authority of the Senate. It cannot be imposed upon us given this constitutionality issue. And I'm more than willing to sign an affidavit saying that I'll comply with it. And I think most members will.
Senator Brown.
Well, I agree with both Senator Courtney and Senator Minnis in that I think we can do an internal rule or internal agreement or whatever you want to call it that says we will comply with the spirit of ORS 260-174 and that we can hold ourselves to higher standards than what the Constitution requires. I think Senator Courtney is exactly right. If we were to go through our rules or our processes, some of those, when put against the Constitution, would in themselves be a constitutional question. Secondly, the key piece in all this is the enforcement piece. And if we can do the rule, but if we don't do any sort of enforcement, it's all sort of, it doesn't make, and there's no reason to do it. And that is, if you want to do the reporting on the Senate floor, that's fine. Obviously, the issue I think would come up is, in fact, you do have a member running for another office, and they end up spending, you know, an hour of the Senate business reporting their contributions on the Senate floor. I think 48-hour reporting, or if you want to do 24-hour reporting through the Secretary of State's office electronically, makes sense for all legislators, all elected officials, and I think we need to look at other candidates out there because they may have business in front of the legislature as well. So I do believe we will have draft legislation in the next couple of days.
For
the 48-hour reporting.
Okay, I'll make it 24.
You want to make it 24?
Yeah. 24. Would you and Randy, Kate, be willing to put your heads together over the next day and try and come up with something we can take a look at?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Sure.
And I would appreciate it if you'd run this by Chamoff. just to do due diligence there, just to make sure. And we've heard the voluntary aspects, you know, spirit and intent. We'll probably use the same words as much as we can, I would assume, because I think that's a major element. It was a pretty good rule for 20 years. Will that be something you guys would be willing to do for us?
Sure.
Fairly quickly? And then Senator Brown? Craig and I will take a look at the CNE aspect of that.
Okay.
Work with Secretary of State and make sure we understand where we need to go on that.
Okay. I think basically what we want is we want to know very basic information, like, and maybe we want to put a limit on it, like $50 or more, or maybe $100 or more, but we want to know how much it is,
who's
going to, and where it came from. I mean, it's pretty straightforward information.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at your product as just the Senate rule that we can all buy into. Is that fair?
Okay.
With the exception, Mr. Chairman, I'm just thinking of the, how do you, when you adopt these rules, my guess is you're going to have, at least in the next session, you'll have a whole lot of rules in one stack. And then you'll have this somehow, I think, separate and distinct voluntary arrangement.
I view this as just Senate rules.
As you said.
20.1, up or down, just as a Senate rule. That's what I'm thinking right now.
But if you...
Is that you have something to think about?
Well, I don't see it. Most of the other Senate rules we don't treat as voluntary.
Yeah, it's like it could be a...
This particular portion is something different because of the Constitution, so we may have to come up with some separate statement posted on the wall.
Keep it as simple as we can and get the job done, I think is what...
I'm hoping I didn't miss something here. I thought that we have no constitutional problem with requiring reporting. There wasn't a constitutional issue there.
No,
well, that reporting requirement does not have to be voluntary.
We think it's either a statute or a Secretary of State rule, one or the other.
I mean, even announcing on the floor the action, which seems, I understand it was similar, we can do that.
Reporting.
And that's mandatory, and you can face sanctions as a member by violating the rules.
And it's taking the silly thing is the part that's fine.
That's voluntary.
I'm trying to sort out the voluntariness side of this thing. The sanctions that can be rendered against a member for non-compliance, my assumption is only to the extent that they have signed the affidavit saying I'm coming under the authority of. But then you just raised another question, that is, if they did, notwithstanding of that, and that's something we need to kind of flush out a little bit, if they didn't sign the affidavit, but they were also compelled to report, then it may very well be permissible for the Senate to sanction someone who didn't report. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it's the reporting versus the...
Versus
disclosure. Yeah. So anyway, this gets more complex the more we talk.
Yeah, let's let you two take a quick run at it. It says, I think, and we get this out, let's all take a look, take this to the caucuses and get this thing rolling as quick as we can. Yeah. While we're on Senate rules, there's several others that we still want to work with. I don't want to get them today. 335, explanation of vote. Senator Dukes wanted to clean that up a little bit, so I'll get you guys a, make it a little bit easier. We didn't quite finish that the other day. Senator Beyer has amendments from the floor, SR 540, that he wants to talk about. Maybe we'll spring a half hour in a committee sometime, Lee, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get into it right now. To talk about that a little bit. On 8:15, the committee meetings, I made an admin mistake, and what you voted on is not what we agreed to do. So we'll have to go back and change that. We didn't vote on the posting it on the second, third floor. We voted on the other one. That was just, I made an admin mistake on that, so that just needs to be cleared up administratively. And then, the rest of them we're doing on this other thing today. So, okay, so there'll be a few more Senate rules that we'll be talking about over the next several days also, just kind of clean up stuff. Right.
Frequently characterize the kind of mistakes you make, the admin mistakes.
I do. Admin.
Other varieties of
mistakes.
Yes,
they're real mistakes and they're admin mistakes. Yeah. For those of you that were late, we started off, we'll try very hard to start on time. I consider that a personal matter of pride. And it's also what we owe the public. We'll run through this. I'm not a big hang up on admin, so I appreciate you keeping me straight so Secretary of the Senate doesn't get after me as much as possible. But also when we're going through here, it's my intent or my goals to kick stuff out of committee at the 7-0 level as much as we can and get them through our bill to the floor at the 20-25 level as much as we can. I'm not going crazy on this, but that's what we'd like to start out as. So, any other thing we need to do? We had a discussion the other day with each one of you individually about committee direction. We've got the reapportionment, which, by the way, will demand that we modify the committee rules to some extent a little bit later. We'll have a discussions on term limits, annual sessions, and then election reform. Whatever that means, the Chad discussions as we go. But those are the big ones that I've seen that crop up at the moment.
Mr. Chair, another issue that was raised since you and I have met was the issue of initiative reform.
And
I think it comes
had a discussion.
Over and over. Okay. There's some other interesting, very clever and very interesting ideas out there.
Senator Beyer has what I think is, what we're going to do is just have a day where we talk about those topics in detail as much as we can, gather up all the bills, just have an initiative day, a term limits day or something, and then figure out what to do next. So I think that's a really good idea. So we might see that as a format. Field hearings on reapportionment, probably at least five from each district. Maybe I'd say at least five. Somewhere between probably 15 February, 15 March, in that time frame. So the mechanics of that, we don't know yet what we'll do, but it's important that we get this thing out and we talk to people, make sure that we hear what they have to say. So that's what I think we're doing. So. Okay, with that, can we adjourn now?
I guess I don't understand the role of this.